Let me begin by talking about an email that went out from Kevin upon my direction, and it included something about the process that we're going to follow during the motion and amendment for the expanded budget. The first thing I want to tell you is that the Thursday night meeting is canceled. There is no Thursday night voting meeting. And I would hope that, I'm sure there's not going to be any objections to that.
Are we going to add another meeting?
We will add another meeting. We have a big number of meetings already on there. And my sense is if we need to, as we go through the process, we will add another meeting. But I'm not going to add the meeting today. Okay? So until further notice, the Thursday night meeting is canceled. One of the reasons for doing that is we have two of the biggest departments we're dealing with in the county this evening, the health department and DSS. And if there were motions that were going to be made by any legislators, we had said that we would like 48 hours in advance of the meeting, and there may not be time enough to do that. My sense is, after having some conversations with people, that we really needed to delay it and start the voting next Monday evening rather than this Thursday evening, so everyone would have the opportunity to think about it, put their motions together, get them to Kevin, and we could operate at that point. At the end of this meeting, I want to go over what the process will be on motions and amendments to the tentative budget as we move to December 10th, which is the evening we're scheduled to adopt the budget, which now means that we've been working on the budget for 18 months. So. Okay. At any rate, I hope there's no objections to the fact that we will not have a meeting on Thursday night. We will schedule extras, and I will give you enough lead time if we need extra meetings, but my sense is now that we may not need extra meetings. Frank, you had a question?
Sure.
Okay, all right. Last year, we basically adopted last year's schedule to this year, and without any changes, and we did not need all the meetings we had last year. So, I'm thinking that even though it's a tough budget year and there are many things people have to do, we should have enough time to get the things done with the remaining meetings. If not, we'll schedule another meeting. But for this time, there is no meeting on Thursday. This evening, we have scheduled Board of Elections, Assigned Council, Health Department, Social Services, and our students right there. Can we put it up? Also, there may be another department, the county historian, sliced in the middle of this for a short period of time if she makes it here. If you remember, she did not appear the other evening for a variety of reasons, one of which was probably my fault, and she thought she was dealing with someone, and that person wasn't here anymore. At any rate, she'll make it in here. It's about $2,000, and there's no OTRs involved in it. So is there anything, Joe, do you have anything you want to say starting out?
No.
Kevin? We'll run through the process at the end, and so I think we can begin with the Board of Elections, and here they are.
Okay.
Okay, Board of Elections, major services that we provide, we conduct elections throughout the county. We staff, and we evaluate, and we choose each polling site, and we train our poll site managers and election inspectors for all the elections that we run. And in that training, we include diversity and sensitivity training. We assist approximately, next year, being a local year, we'll be assisting approximately 70 candidates to ensure that they fulfill all the legal requirements regarding campaign finance and getting on the ballot and running for office. We conduct voter registration. Another major part of our operation is absentee voting for permanently disabled voters, for voters that are not going to be here on Election Day, and for military voters overseas, and federal voters this year that are overseas. We maintain all the voting equipment. We program all the ballots for each of the elections. We do have to conduct quarterly maintenance on all of our equipment and report to the State Board of Elections on all of the activities that we do with the machines. In 2010, after last year's election, we created in 2009, we created an award-winning project management tool using Open Project, and we use this now for the execution of all of our elections. We've held 15 public demonstrations of the new voting equipment this year. We're implementing the Military MOVE Act, which enables not only military but federal voters overseas, if they don't get their ballots in time or if ballots get changed, they have the ability to interact with the State Board of Elections website and download a ballot for their election district and mail that ballot in. We've rolled out new voting equipment for the whole county, as you know. This year, everybody is now voting on the new system. We've created our in-house our voter a video, a demo video that for our poll site managers so that they can review it to learn how to make sure they remember how to set up the machines and take them down on election night. We've created our own posters and we've corrected some privacy issues that have existed for voters. And the commissioners, we actually train all of our workers with the help of some of our technicians, but we trained over 400 workers for Election Day this year. Essentially, we have two offices now with only one additional full-time equivalent. We have our facility at 1771 Hanshaw, and we have our obviously our office downtown, 128 East Buffalo, and at our voting machine center at 1771 Hanshaw, we work on the machines. That's where all the machines are. But we do a lot of our training there, and many of the procedures that we have to do with everything we do is pretty much dictated by the state election law, but with the new machines, there's much more to be done. And while we are putting the primary to bed now, we have only 5 weeks in between the two elections to really get the machines all stripped down and get them all reprogrammed with a new election and, get the ballots printed and all that. So we end up with, for this election here, we've loaded 71 different ballots onto the 43 voting machines, or actually 47 voting machines for this year's election. And we have to test deck each one of those ballots and make sure that they tabulate. That's a very time-consuming process. And we have to pack the machines up and get them out to the polling sites. It's a very, very busy time right now. And at the same time we're doing all that with the machines, we have our office workers are right now being inundated with voter registration forms, absentee ballot requests. They're ordering the ballots. We've received them already. They're preparing the poll books and waiting on the public and supplying the state with weekly reports and assisting candidates.
Yeah, just this week we have day and night crews going up until 9 o'clock the whole week.
Doing the test decking for the machines. And this is just an example of the what we've created on Open Project. It's a free project management tool that we use, and it's been very helpful to stay on top of all the tasks with.
What does it do?
What
does it do? It's a tool for what?
It's a tool so that we can stay on top of all of the different tasks that everybody is doing, and they can stay on top, and also they can look at it and make sure that they are staying on task.
If our political calendar is so tight, if someone doesn't do task A, task B can't be completed. So everyone has to know exactly what they're doing on that day in order for us to move forward.
Question.
Sure. Go ahead, Frank.
In the old days, in public works, we had what was known as a critical path timetable.
Exactly,
is that
what
this
that is?
Exactly.
It took a long time to write this program because the critical path was cutting into the dates of the political calendar, so we had to keep starting over again in order for it to fill
get,
it out.
To get election day back to
right.
Will the date shift depending upon what the state sets as different dates when there are due dates for things?
Yeah, we have to reset it for every election.
Yeah, we literally reset it every
and
time.
And your whole staff has access to this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, and we can print it out by task. We can print it out by resources. So everyone has their own copy of what tasks they need to do.
Oh, that's good.
Martha.
What was the award you won, and are you sharing this with other counties?
Well, the New York State Board of Elections awarded us a best practice for this. We submitted it, and they thought it was worthy, and we have shared this with several other counties. That's the one good thing. I mean, all the counties are pretty good at sharing their ideas with other counties.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
In order to meet our budget requirements for 2011, we've had already significant reductions in 2010, and most of those are going forward. As of right now, our primary elections are no longer in our target funding. So in order to do, which we just did, a full countywide primary, it costs almost $33,000. Next year, and for one time, we've asked for $10,000 in order to cover the expenses that we feel may be for the next primary. Also, we've been covering training, the extra training for the inspectors, so we cut $10,000 in training from the inspectors. Next year, we'll only have the one mandated training for inspectors in our base budget.
Keep going.
Okay.
I'll wait till you finish with that slide.
And just so that you know, how we've always trained in the past was we trained just before primary, just before general, and then one main training. So next year we'll be down to one total training, and that's it. We're doing a lot of hands-on with the inspector over the phone and not having as much training on the machines and stuff as more as talking them through it next year.
We put some of the training on video.
Yeah,
which we give them a DVD.
Which we created all in-house.
Right.
And then we had cut our travel and training, and we continue to do that. We had also cut staffing hours, and we cut our machine technicians. Were not ever in the base budget because we were waiting for full implementation to see how much we needed them, and we have finally fully implemented, and we know that we need them full time for 6 months out of the year. So that was also cut from one FTE to down to a half FT, and it's split bipartisan as always. And then, of course, we're not replacing any equipment, and we've zeroed out any kind of repairs for next year as well.
Could we hold the question till the end?
Sure.
Okay. Could I have Peter, Frank, and then Carol?
So continue on.
So what we've requested for this year, just to maintain our services is we had to, in order to absorb the cut this year, we had to cut our senior election clerks from full-time to half-time. And again, it's two because of the bipartisan nature of our office. We really only have six full-time employees, so that's almost a third of cut in staffing. And we would like to now request our senior voting machine technicians to be in our base budget because they have been one time for the last couple years. And again, we probably should have some expenses for primary in our base budget, which is now outside of our base budget. We may have a citywide primary, and $10,000 would cover the cost of paying all the inspectors and moving the machines and such. And that's the $10,000. So the loss of our senior technicians working alongside of us for election would cause us really to be out of compliance with state and federal law. There would be no voter outreach, no education would all have to be eliminated. Preparing each machine and the maintenance and the testing would all be delayed. We wouldn't be able to certify the election timely. Testing of equipment, I don't know really how we'd do it without the senior technicians, so that's where you find if there's any problems with the machines before you go to election day, and it's required. Absentee ballots would not be mailed in a timely manner. Voters may lose their right to vote, or it could cause someone to lose an election. And recently, because of lack of staff, and when you hear reports out in the public, it's with problems at the poll, it's usually inadequate training and from lack of proper staffing. Again, with our OTRs, we talked about the primaries, and that's a mandated program, but we wouldn't know what to expect in costs after the July petition filing. So if we wanted to work it that way again, we could tell you at the end of July. And the loss of two full-time employees of our department of six would literally stop the process for printing the ballots, registering voters, waiting on the public, you know, mailing absentee ballots. So this is the staffing is really a critical issue to us. And then this is just our spending for the last 5 years. As you can see, in 2008, our spending always goes up in a presidential year. So we actually have to have extra one-time help during 2008. And then slowly we have been absorbing the decreases because of the constraints of the budget. And this is our total expenditures. Part of that is chargebacks to the towns are included in that. And then our over-target requests, again, are two senior techs. The increase in fringes, the senior clerks back to full-time in the primary. And that's our total expenditure if we do not see our over-target request completed. This is what it would end up. And then we just wanted to show you, does it make a difference? So since 2007, we've had 11 races within 9 votes. County Legislator Pat Pryor won by 7 votes in 2009, and we had town council and clerk positions won by 8. And as you can see, I won't go through them all, but elections really do count in Tompkins County. And every time we go to the high schools to talk to the students, I'll say, you know, why aren't you interested in voting? And they said, well, because it doesn't make a difference. Well, in Tompkins County, I don't remember here we're not counting ballots.
Please slide down to 1971.
Can everybody read that?
Can you blow that up? Can you blow that one up?
It's the last time you lost, huh?
It was probably the best thing that ever happened to you, right?
So really, that's the end of our presentation. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I had Peter, Frank, then Carol.
Well, let's see. First, I feel a little bit
hurt that you left out Peter Stein, who won by 6 votes and won that prize.
I know, I should have had that.
But that isn't the question I had. This is, what you're asking for is in the recommended budget, is that correct?
Yes.
So, if in fact we pass the recommended budget, were those unfortunate things that you listed in your slide, will they take place, that absentee ballots will not be counted in a timely fashion and so forth? So
no, we actually, because you've allowed us to have enough staffing, we were the first ones to get our ballots mailed out in the state, I believe. We were the first ones to actually get our ballots printed. Mm-hmm. We had to mail military ballots out a second time because the state changed their certification, so the ballot changed. So we're able to keep up on all this. And like, if any changes happen in the programming of the ballots, which we've never done before, it's not something where you just go in and you highlight it and make the change. The program actually makes you go back to the beginning. So you almost have to start over to get everything in there. And the program's restricted, so we can't make any changes that would make our life easier.
It seems to me, just as I was listening to you, it seems to me that you can't really predict how much work you're going to have, because particularly with primaries, I mean, some years you can have none, some years you can be overloaded with primaries. And the work you have to do must be proportional, I would think, to the number of places you have primary campaigns, right?
Right. And like tonight, our staff is all staying, and we hadn't predicted that, but we had a rush of people coming in, and we weren't able to keep up with the registration flow. And we've been really fortunate with all our staff. They're very flexible. They stay. They know when they need to stay, and we can't say enough good things about them.
Friday was the deadline. This past Friday was the deadline for registering to vote for this election. So it was a lot of forms came in over the weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Actually, in 1971, what they discovered, too, is I was 2 years underage in that election. So,
was that 1872?
Back the slide that says meeting the 2011 budget requirement, can you go back to that one just a second? Peter picked up on some of what I was going to ask. Every primary, whether it's village, town, county, what about school districts? And what about the school district election?
I'm glad you asked about that, because you left that out.
I mean, is that another expense that's not in this?
That would probably be offset by revenue, though.
We're hoping to have some revenue. The school districts have not decided yet. We assist them, and we bring in some revenue, and we're hoping to assist them more and bring in more revenue, because we do not want anyone touching our machines but anyone that's certified training on them. So in the Ithaca City School District, we're waiting to hear from them to see if they would like to use our services.
And any of the other municipalities, town, city, if there's an election or a primary in there, do they share in any of the expense whatsoever?
Yes. We took over when we centralized all the elections, which did make sense, but we took over most all of the expenses. But what they do share in are the printing of the ballots. That would be the major cost.
I don't know if you have this page, but on our page 19, it shows other miscellaneous revenue of about $122,000. Would it be included in that?
Yes, that's what's considered? That's exactly where it is.
Okay. Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks, Steve.
Carol.
Yeah, I have two questions. One is about the training cuts. In either the base budget or the over-target requests that we tentatively granted, is there anything in there to respond to the requests we've had for added cross-cultural training for poll inspectors?
Well, we have included, you know, since last year, we have added a segment to our training of all of our poll workers that discusses the whole issue of, you know, cross culture and respecting the people you work with and the people that come in to vote, and try to make them aware that, you know, the county has a policy, a no tolerance policy with regards to discrimination, and we've incorporated that in. And actually, it's kind of nice because two or three people have come up to me after the training and thanked me for, or thanked us for including it in the training.
Okay, so it's in there.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
So the training,
the $10,000 that was cut for inspectors, what would that involve?
Well, right now we're starting a brand new system that's new to everybody. And, you know, first couple of years we've had, with help from the Help America Vote Act, there's some federal funds that have helped us offset some of the training. But we don't have any of that money available. And so now we're moving forward into a new phase where we do have to train them once a year. And so we're trying to find other things that we can do to help with that training without having to go with more than one training, which they really do need. And that's why we have created an in-house video to help the people that have to get the machines up and running, that they can watch and see a step-by-step process so they can refresh their memory, because they only do this a couple times a year. And, you know, when you only do something two times a year, it's...
Okay, thanks. And then... is there anything further that we could be doing or that other counties do to respond to the sort of the boom and bust cycle of elections, where there are times that you need more people, or, you know, staff people? Do other counties have ways that they call on employees from other departments to be trained to help just on those really high volume days? In a way that we could piggyback across departments, not necessarily for this year and in mm-hmm. the future, if we didn't meet the over target requirement.
We really already have, we have county employees that are working Election Day for us. That's helping us a lot. If it's something that isn't required of a bipartisan team, we have utilized ITS personnel and assessment.
Because they're nearby.
And we also have a lot of people that really kind of just volunteer their time. So we're the only thing that would help our calendar, and they probably will vote on next year, is moving the primary. We'll probably have June primaries. And the reason being is because there's no way with the state certifying the election and with our five-week period to actually mail the ballots out. Without having to mail a second out when the ballot's actually finalized. So that will help our calendar considerably, spread it out more.
Thanks.
Mike?
I'm continuing to have problems with this over target for the primary and the fact that it's not recommended by the administrator. Primary elections are a mandate, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that means we have to do primary mandates unless just don't happen to be one. If we say, well, if there was no primary, then we don't have to hit contingency. That's okay. But otherwise, I think we're playing the odds that saying that we've already, before we started, spent $10,000 out of contingency every year. We certainly know that happened this year, whatever the amount was for that. Why is this an over target instead of being part of your base budget if it is a mandate?
Well, we had no way to absorb the decreases from last year, and that was the only cost we had that was flexible, because sometimes you only have a couple of towns that have a primary, so then you don't spend $38,000. And then other times, like this year, we spent $38,000, so we had some wiggle room there, and so we offered it up because we know that every time we're not spending the $38,000.
Was there $38,000 the previous year?
No.
No. Last year there was two primaries, one in County Legislative District 11 and Town of Enfield.
When was the last time that there was a line item in your budget for primary? Or has this been contingency for years?
No.
This just started.
Just started. Last year, I think, was the first year.
Yeah. Just this year.
So how much were you carrying before that?
It was carrying, you could carry anywhere from, we've never not had a primary, so it's not 38,000. But what it was doing was coming back into our budget as rollover, and we were rolling it over again for full implementation.
Part of this year's primary. Never not had a primary.
Right. As long as I've been there.
Yeah. Martha.
Did you say, I thought you said 32.
Oh, 32, I'm sorry. Yes, not 38, 32. Thank you.
And could you explain again what the relationship with the school district is? The school districts are?
Right now, the school districts historically have run their own elections. What they have used us for is support for lists of voters. They've used us to ask us if they could, for the names of our technicians, so that they can use them to set up the machines.
But they use our machines?
And they used our lever machines. Well, now that we're into the new voting machines, we offered our machines before. We're currently working on getting rid of the lever machines, but we offered each of the school districts the machines, if they would wanted them. Trumansburg School District took us up. The Lansing School District took us up on it. And the Groton School District took us up on it.
On the op scan or the levers?
On taking the lever machines. Now, what they're going to do with them, state education law, covers how they run their elections. If they'll state education law will let them use the lever machines, they're going to be good. If they won't allow them, and they want to use our machines, then we will have to enter into some sort of an agreement with them as to how much we're going to charge them to set those machines up and, do all the things that they need to do to use them.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for BOE? Peter, and then Stu.
Yeah, quick question. Is that a courtesy, the help that you give the school district, or do you charge them for the time?
Our staff time?
Yeah, for the things you do.
Right. The staff time is a courtesy, and then we do get a little bit of revenue from printing the poll books, and they pay us to visit the nursing homes because that's a requirement as well before each election.
And they pay for the lists and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
Last question, Julie.
This is a question about ballot design, which may or may not be relevant to the budget. You do that in-house.
Yep.
Do you take it anywhere to have ordinary voters look at it to see? Do you have a test panel that you use?
Well, this is one of our problems with the system, with the company that these ballots are created in the election management system that the manufacturer and the State Board of Elections work together to design the software for. And right now we're very limited on our ballot design. I would definitely like to look at some options there. We had some feedback after the primary, some very good feedback from some voters, which were, if we get the ability to have some flexibility in designing our ballots, right now the election management system doesn't offer us a lot of flexibility, but if we get it, then we can probably design better ballots. Ballot we have for this year, it's a very concentrated ballot with a lot of names on it, a lot of races, and a lot of parties. It's going to be the voters this year should, they're going to have to take their time and make sure they read the directions, and they should be fine. But, if they're going to be just relaxed and cavalier about it, then there may be some problems, but I think it'll work well.
Yeah. We just hosted a regional meeting, and we voted as a region to send to the State Board of Elections and to our vendor changes that we would like in the ballot. Because the lines between each race need to be darker, and we can't darken them.
The ovals
need to be darkened, and we can't darken them. There's just many changes that would make it more friendly.
Placement of the ovals. We had some recommendations mm-hmm. about that. But we don't have any flexibility right now. No flexibility. Hopefully we will.
Well, if there's some way we can help you.
If you could write the state, that would be great.
I think the GO committee maybe might. We should take that up.
Mike. Are we going to have any better kinds of voting booths? These ones that have been in the polling place that have anything but privacy for the voters.
Should be something with a curtain.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about a curtain. Privacy is an issue that we've been addressing, and I think we've been making some inroads on. The main thing is that we try to urge our election inspectors that when they give the person the ballot, they give it to them with a privacy folder. And some places we're finding, you know, that's not being done as well as it should be. Part of it is I think some people come in and they just say, I don't need that.
No,
they get two or three people say they don't need
it. What I'm asking about are these yellow metal things that you call booths, mm-hmm. Which I think you need actual booths. People go behind a curtain and mark their ballot so they have the privacy of that sanctum.
It probably can be done. You know, if you want, I could look into the cost associated with it, but I'm sure it'll be significant.
Well, I just want to make that comment.
Okay. No other questions? Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
I notice in the audience that the county historian has arrived, and what my plan is, Carol, that we have assigned counsel now, and then I would have you at the end of that. Sure.
I am the program coordinator for the assigned counsel program, and this is the new supervising attorney who came to the assigned counsel program in July, Wesley McDermott. This is his first time going through this process. He's very excited.
Julia.
So he wanted to be here with me.
Julia, can you move your microphone over?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. The assigned counsel program receives and reviews all applications for free attorneys services. We determine eligibility, financial eligibility, including automatic eligibility by public assistance, poverty level, and the inability to afford counsel. The attorneys are provided for charges including violations, misdemeanors, felonies, and appeals in criminal court. And we cover most matters in family court, such as custody, visitation, and neglect. Those are the three biggies that we cover in family court. We do not cover everything in family court. We have two budget units in the assigned counsel program. We have the administration side, which is the staff, and if our secretary was here, you would see the whole department. We're very small. The other part of the budget process is the mandate, the attorney's fees, what the attorneys charge for the cases that they provide services for. The only item that we have a target for is the administrative side, and this is the total expenditures for 2010 and 2011. The reason why there was a 17% increase is because when Wes McDermott became the supervising attorney, the salary was increased. Mr. Stolp was a supervising attorney for 32 years, and he received, as part of his benefit package, health insurance. What happened when Wes came on is he was given an increase in pay to $31,000 at a one-third time employee, but no benefits. Even though he does not receive benefits, we still have to charge the fringe rate. So that's why there's an increase of that amount for Mr. McDermott's salary. So we have 2.3 full-time employees, and that hasn't changed. We have had 2.3 since the inception of the program in 1990. So our over-target request is to restore the hours for myself and the secretary of the department. What would happen if we went along with the 6.9% decrease, which the only thing that we have to cut is hours. The secretarial position would be cut to 30 hours. My position would be cut to 32.5. In order to restore the hours, our over-target request is $18,346, plus we have $500, which is Tyler, which was our rollover. So our target for the number one is for my hours, including fringes, and number two is for the secretaries, including fringes. And both were recommended by the administrator. The reason that we have an increase in workload is because our caseload is steadily increasing, and I will show you a chart to that effect in a moment. Also, the state has formed a new commission that we must respond to in order to receive state aid. This new commission by the state is something that will go into effect sometime next year, and it is called the Office of Indigent Legal Services. The office and the board have been given broad powers to collect information, monitor performance, distribute funds, and take actions to improve the quality of indigent defense services. And Joe Mariana has been appointed to that commission by the governor. So we're very happy about that. But it will mean an increase in workload to us. We are going to have to be more accountable to the state for data input, and also in order to get state aid, part of it, we are going to have to make a grant request where we have not done that in the past. That is something that we have coming down the pike. We don't know what it's involved. We just think it's going to be mean a lot more work, especially for Joe. We are organizing also continuing legal education trainings on current legal issues before the courts. We've had two trainings since West came on in July. Both of them were attended by 50 individuals. These trainings were about the Rockefeller drug law reforms at the request of Judge Rowley. And the last one that we had was about immigration issues, Padilla versus Kentucky, which is how immigration, your immigration status can be affected by a criminal conviction. We think that these trainings will improve the quality of our panel and the quality of our program, and we offer these trainings for free. And these are mandated to the attorneys that we have, so we think by offering them for free that more of them will come on board and hopefully make our program a little bit better. This is the caseload chart that I wanted to show you. It's really a rough draft. It could be more in detail. I worked with it with Kevin Sutherland. I broke it down by year, by the subsections. Each section can be broken down further. You can tell that the biggest change that we have had is in denials. Even though when we deny someone assigned counsel, we still do a fair amount of work. In fact, when we deny someone, we do more work than when we assign an attorney. What we have to do is it has to go to Wes, it's appeal to Wes. If the client has to bring in more documentation, it then goes to the judge. We then speak to the judge about it. So it is a lot more work for us. And you can tell that we've had a lot more denial. We will probably have a lot more denials this year. And that's just based upon the economy because we've had so many more people apply for assigned counsel. As you can tell, the administrative side has gone up a little bit. The biggest jump was because the fringes were then included. And the mandate side has gone up steadily. I don't know if you can read the state aid that we received. Last year, we were told that we were going to receive $413,000, and we received $359,000. I received an email this morning, and I'm told that we're supposed to receive the same amount next year. 90% of it will be mandated by the state, this commission, and 10% of it we will have to apply for by grant. And as each year goes, that what we have to apply for by grant will increase. And we have to prove to the state that we have improved our program in some way, shape, or form in order to receive the funds. This is something that we have never, ever done before in the past. So this is a whole new ball game for all of us. We have some new initiatives that we're trying in order to create some new revenue. This came out of the task force report that we had about a year ago. We are asking non-emancipated minors for parental information. If the parent is financially eligible, we are asking them to reimburse the county. We have some cases like that pending at the moment. We also have an open dialogue with the courts. We are asking them for suggestions on how we may cut costs. And, in fact, Judge Rossiter has implemented a new timetable to take attorneys who have a few cases she's taking earlier, attorneys have three or more she's taking later in the morning, trying to stagger it. We're also trying to batch cases in the courts so that there's not travel time according to where the attorney lives. I have three attorneys who live in Dryden. I have three attorneys who live in Ulysses. So each attorney is given multiple cases to cover for that particular case. And that was one of the things that was big in the task force report. We're also trying to implement other measures from the task force report, but Wes is new. We're just getting our feet under us, and I think that by next year we'll have some other things that we're going to try to implement. That was about all I had for you.
I have Frank, who has his hand up, and Dooley. The new initiatives, you're good with that. Okay, Frank and then Dooley.
Thanks, Drew and Wes, for the presentation. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. Mm-hmm. First, a year or so ago, maybe a little longer than that, there was an unusual circumstance where we had to prove that we weren't doing something, remember that, in order to collect. The state had asked us to do something in order to retain the money that we were receiving.
Maintenance of effort.
Yeah. Has that straightened out now?
Well, I'm told that we are no longer going to have maintenance of effort because of this new commission. What will happen is they will give us a percentage of the funds that they are receiving based upon some formula, and then 10% of it this year or next year we will have to ask for by a grant. So the maintenance of effort will no longer be in place.
Be applicable. The other is recoveries. Are you responsible for working with some other entity to see if any of the people that had been assigned counsel can pay, like this parental item on the new initiatives? But is there an effort being made to go back and have anyone who was assigned counsel pay for some of the services if their circumstances eventually permit that, if they've improved their job or whatever?
You mean being retroactive?
Yeah.
We have not looked at past cases. We have some cases right now where we're talking to the judges to sign 722D orders, which is the parents would be involved in reimbursing the county, but we have not looked at the cases retroactive. What happens is the county attorney is responsible to ask for the funds after a 722D order is signed by the judge. It's up to the county attorney. So what we're doing is we're working with Susie Cook in the county attorney's office, and we're going to be turning them over to her.
But that's only for the parental piece.
That's only for the parental piece.
There's another part
that...
Wes, you got to use emergency.
Another part. In fact, I dictated a letter today to go to all of the judges. Often there are appointments from the bench, and very often in those appointments, no one ever bothers to get a financial affidavit to see if the person really was eligible. It's a convenience to the court because they can move the case on and not have to wait for it to be processed and someone assigned. However, I think that there are, well, we know that there are cases that the party probably should not have had assigned attorneys. So I'm asking or suggesting to the courts, suggesting that if they're going to assign from the bench, that at the very least still request the affidavit that establishes their status. And I also indicated that I would then be asking them to consider signing 722D orders, which is the process by which we're able to recover. And what Julie was saying, Susie Cook hopefully will be following up on these orders to recover. It's not automatic, Frank, that just because we have the order doesn't necessarily mean we get paid. Then it's a question of utilizing the tools in the CPLR to try and collect the money. But that is something that's coming, and hopefully we'll get the cooperation of all the town justices and certainly our county court judges.
Thank you. I forgot to talk about the $1.9 million mandate side.
Minor.
I'm sorry. On the mandate side this year, we asked for, based upon our experience, based upon what cases are out there that we know about, our office estimated the mandate side for 2011 would be $1.9 million. That's $200,000 more than last year. The reason for that, from our point of view, is that there are some high-profile crimes that are out there that have not, for whatever reason, come to our office or to the courts yet. If they do, based upon the severity of the crimes, A1 felonies, A2 felonies, we feel that those cases would cost approximately $200,000. If, being the big word, Joe Mariano, when we met with Joe, he split the difference and recommended only $100,000. It may be nothing. It may be $300,000. But that is the reality of what we know at this point. So if those cases do come and they are $200,000 to $300,000, we will be coming back to you maybe sometime later in the year, next year, for contingency funds.
May I make one comment? The caseload, on the caseload slide, I'm seeing the number 1.635728. Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
That's approximate for 2010. That's what we prorated.
Okay. All right. I have Dooley, Martha, Mike, Carol, Peter.
You anticipated one of my questions. Thank you for talking about that.
Sorry, I forgot that part.
I wanted to see if I remembered correctly something OAR told us when they were here, that they do some intake work for assigned counsel.
They do all the jail intakes. We do not go into the jail. We don't have time. We don't have access. OAR is our lifeline to the jail. And they're very resourceful to us. They save us a lot of time. If we have a question, we'll call up and ask, can you talk to so-and-so? Can you ask such-and-such? Questions that wouldn't be appropriate to ask the corrections officer.
Right.
And so we work very closely with them.
And that's been true for quite a long time.
For as long as I've been here.
Yeah, it seems like a good arrangement, but since there was no mention of that in your narrative, I just wanted to make sure.
They are one of the agencies that we do deal with on a daily basis, and we value their services greatly.
Thank you.
I have Martha and Mike.
Thank you. Hi, Wes. Hi, Julia. A couple things. The loss of the elimination of the maintenance of effort requirement is a big deal. That's
yes.
Great. I understand we're still a little unsure how the new formula and the grant applications will work, and that's a little nerve-wracking. In particular, you said we'll have to show that you've improved each year.
There has to be, they're asking for, we received something today, and it says, take actions to improve the quality of indigent defense services. That's what this new commission is about. So when your grant application comes in, I think Joe may be able to talk more to that. They're looking for something specific. I'm just not sure what.
I can't speak to the mechanics of that formula. I'm not that familiar with it. I do know that what they're looking for in assigned council programs throughout the state is the same commitment to quality that they saw here when they came here to look at our program. So it's the state's effort to make sure, again, quality standards are upheld even during tough times like this. So in terms of our confidence, in terms of how we will fare under these new formulas, again, I'm not going to profess to know the nuts and bolts of the formula, but I'm pretty confident that if they're looking for quality, we're going to do just fine in that process.
I just worry if there's some measure by which we're supposed to improve every year and we're already at a top level, what does that mean? So
there's always room for improvement.
Oh, always. Okay, your mom. I'm puzzled by your statement about we still had to charge the fringe rate for Wes's position, even though we're not paying fringes.
It's the way we allocate fringe benefits. We allocate our fringe benefits across the entire payroll base. So when you look at all of these pages, it is basically 51.4% of our payroll base across the board. That's the way we allocate our benefits. For the most part, that works out very equitably. However, there are some departments like this one, fairly small departments, that have these exceptional cases where the individual doesn't get benefits. So basically, their budget does include a full fringe factor as if we were paying Wes those fringe benefits.
Do we pay pension? Or do we pay anything?
You're not a member of the pension system. Does Wes actually receive? No. Right. Neither pension nor health for Wes.
Okay. I'm puzzled. There's no way we can adjust that?
We can choose to adjust it. Yeah, but again, the general approach has been to spread our benefits across the entire payroll base.
Okay, if you could help us understand when we come to voting, what mechanism, how we would modify that, not to take any expense away, that funding for a real expense, but if we're not paying for something, actually paying for it, it shouldn't be in here, I think.
At least not in this budget, yeah.
Okay, and the issue about the mandate money makes me think that we should have a look at the contingent fund, and this is a question to Joe, at some, you know, maybe before that we start voting next week, kind of how much it is and what you've included in there.
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I have Mike.
Still on this issue of the fringes and things, is the reason that Wes is not entitled to fringes is because, or the things, because he's less than half time?
Yes.
Okay. Wes, how much time do you spend on this job?
Seriously. Actually, more than I anticipated.
I mean, I would be surprised if there was a third.
I count for that as... learning on a job, I guess, Mike. It depends. Some days I spend a great deal of time. There are those that where I don't have any contact with the office at all, or appeals. That's the other thing, that come directly to me, and I have to deal with them expeditiously as they're made. I really never counted the hours, I guess, at this point. It's whatever needs to be done. I take it from my free time and my practice to do it.
Also on that,
I can sympathize with.
Also on that, for fringes, Martha, I've worked here for 12 years, and my husband works for the town of Ithaca, and I've never received health insurance through the county, so that's something that we've always talked about with Joe and things like that, and hopefully, I think when you have a consortium, maybe that might change or something, but I always felt that I was getting shortchanged too, but...
I know, but this position, there was a specific negotiation having to do with health benefits.
And right.
So, okay.
The question I wanted to ask about is the number of violations that we're assigning folks to. That seems like a fairly high number to me. I realize that we have to do that. Are we assigning them to any violation that someone wants? Do we have certain levels within the violations where we would appoint someone for an indigent?
Well, for a violation, you can spend up to 15 days in jail. If it's a jailable offense, even if you have a local law for housing or for anything that has a jailable offense, we are required to assign someone to.
So speeding?
If it's a jailable offense,
you get 15 days.
You can get 15 days on a violation, then that is something that we have to cover.
I realize that we have to cover the violations. In the past, that wasn't the case. I don't think it was always that violations were covered. But maybe I'm wrong there.
For as long as I've been here, I've been here for 12 years, and we have always covered violations.
Interesting. Thank you, mm-hmm. Carol.
Yeah. The negative OTR. I'm not quite understanding. I'm not sure if this is a question for Joe or for you folks. Why it's a negative OTR as opposed to a change in the base budget.
The department requested that elevated amount. So the department, and it's a mandated cost, so they lifted up that mandated expense. And the only way I can make a change to that departmental request, is by basically a negative over target request, which we've come to coin an under target request. So that's the way you see exactly what I did to this budget. I took their request and I reduced it by $100,000. You can see that there's still an element of growth in there. You can see that there is, in normal years, a certain stability in that expense. You can see it's $1.7 million in 08, $1.7 million in 09. Budgeted $1.7 million for 2010. So in normal times, there is a certain amount of stability in that expense. And I think what Wes and Julia brought to my attention was there are certain, as they said, high-profile, big-time cases that are on the horizon, and they want to make sure they're covered for that. I think the addition of $100,000 is an appropriate amount to put in that budget to hedge that risk. So, again, at this point, it's everybody's best educated guess, but I think $100,000 is appropriate.
Peter. Thank you.
There was a slide of new initiatives. The third bullet, I'm not sure it covers what I heard. At a meeting of the assigned council group, I thought there was a real problem about lawyers being brought in to conduct a case early in the morning, and then they were there hours and hours getting paid, waiting for the judge to get to their case.
And that's what we're trying to...
Now, is that what's covered by the third bullet?
That's what we're trying to occur. We're trying, so the attorney is not waiting 2 or 3 hours to be called up to the bench by the judge, so that we're giving them X amount of cases.
If I may, the batching of cases is a separate function.
Right, it didn't sound like that's
no,
what that was.
What I have asked the judges to do is make suggestions. I've pointed out that one judge in the county has dramatically affected this waiting time by setting, he has a very busy court, and by setting a separate time for assigned cases before the general calendar. And it's been very effective and helps us. I can't tell the judges that they should do this. I have, in the letter asking them for suggestions, pointed out that this particular judge has done this, and it's been a big savings to the program, in hopes that some of the busier courts might decide that they too would do this. But I can't tell them that they have to do that. But it would help.
It would be nice to know if you're successful in the quest for efficiency.
Well, a number of the judges have written back with suggestions, and in fact, Judge Rossiter is, as Julia said, changing her calendar practice, and that will affect us. By the waiting time, by separating those who have two cases at 9:30, and then those that have three or more at 10:30. So that is a step in the right direction. That will help us. I'd like to see a couple of the other busy courts decide that they would adopt the separate time for signed cases, but I can't force that.
No other questions? Thank you both very much. I'm going to insert the county historian. Carol, if you would come to the back microphone, please, and in your budget book, it's page 45. We passed out a sheet the other day, and if you have them, fine. If not, if you look in the budget book under C, you will see it. It is a total request of $7,000, and the total unit cost is $2,000 because of some other miscellaneous revenue. But go ahead.
I like following assigned counsel. $7,000 doesn't sound so terrible. So thank you very much. The county historian has been busy this year. We are meeting monthly with all the municipal historians, and I think there is a good deal of history activity going on, especially concerned with the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, which is coming up beginning in April. And that's what the increase in the county historian's budget is all about. I only get the $5,000, and the $2,000 has been assigned to the Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission, which is being co-chaired by Mike Lane and myself. What we are doing on that commission, is if this is what you'd like me to talk about, is we have negotiated with Cornell, who is negotiating with a vendor to have all of the Tompkins County newspapers digitized, and they will be available with a search facility, which is a phenomenal change in how one gets at materials in the past. New cemetery stones are going up, replacing the veteran stones that have either disappeared or have disintegrated. 15 have been put in, and I think we have a goal of something like 200 for this coming year and a half. And there is a crew of people actually working very hard doing the research and working with the federal government. The government provides the stones. They get sent here. So far, they've been sent to the city of Ithaca, and the city work crews have helped put the new stones in. So that's all working very nicely. A scholarship fund has been established in conjunction with the Tompkins County, the Tompkins-Cortland Community College Foundation, and the scholarship will honor the four women who went from Tompkins County to serve as nurses during the Civil War, and that's an ongoing effort. So far, we have covered the cost of two scholarships, and we are soliciting money for the rest. We have over 100 people who have contributed from $10 to a possible $6,000, which we're working very closely to get. And that's I hope that happens. There will be a website that will be created for the Civil War to announce activities, but also to try to educate the public, because this commission really believes that the anniversary of the war is important in terms of public education about how the county has performed in the past, what our connection to national events is, how national events affect the public, but it also has to do with questions of war and peace, patriotism, how one balances one's conscience with policy, and these are not questions that ended in 1865 when that war ended. We also are considering and working on a lecture series that would be in conjunction with the History Center and with the Tompkins County Public Library, and we hope to use the library space for this to bring people in to talk about the Civil War, not only as it was fought elsewhere, but also as the war was fought here at home. This is a very interesting county because, as you probably all know or don't know or have heard me say before, the county in 1860 voted for Abraham Lincoln, but the city of Ithaca did not. So it was a very divided county in terms of what was going on. Dryden was called Black Dryden because it was so abolitionist. The city of Ithaca was a different story. And so that's the story we'd like to tell about the past, that there have been contested, black was a good word in that case, the issues of the war were contested then as issues of war and peace are still contested. Can I answer any questions?
Martha.
You went by me too fast on that, the digitizing of the newspapers. Would you tell me, explain that again?
Well, when I started doing local history, I read the physical papers from 1861. I turned every page. It took approximately 12 hours to do a year. And that was only a four-page newspaper. Today, I can go into the newspaper and say, Julia Cook, who was a nurse from the town of Dryden who went to the Civil War, and the digitization process will allow me to scan the papers to see any mention of her. It's instantaneous. It is phenomenal. I was born too early.
I'm sorry, so is that digitizing being done, or it's been done?
It's being contracted now. And what has happened is we've worked with Peter Hurdle at the Cornell Library, who was contacted by a company called Digital Archives. And the company wants to use a lot of rare material at Olin Library, in the Cornell Library system. And we had Peter negotiate that in order to use the Cornell materials, we would get the digitization project done. So it's not costing us anything, but this contract hasn't been signed, and I hate even saying that for fear something will happen. Thank you.
Carol, may I ask, and I should be familiar with this, but your other miscellaneous revenues, $5,000, where do you get that from?
That comes from the Strategic Tourism Board.
Okay, that's what I thought. All right, thank you. Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, I have questions about the digitization project, too, which I think is absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. Two questions. One is, I can't believe that you could be doing digitization for anything close to the entire budget from both of these sources. So is there somebody we should be thanking for assistance, or is it the Cornell Library
system? When the contract is signed, I will let you know.
And yes. Then is that something that we will be able to link to and make available to the public, or link through our own website, or will it have to be accessed some other way?
At the moment, the digitization will be available at Cornell for anyone with a Cornell library card or by anyone working in the Tompkins County Public Library. It will not be available outside of that. But we figured we got that much, and it will ease its way out as we work with it. We really were not in a great bargaining position, so we were pleased with what we got. It would have cost probably $80,000 to $100,000 for us to have paid for this.
Right.
So we took what we could get.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think it absolutely sounds wonderful. In terms of your regular, a lot of these are highlights and things you've been able to miraculously put together, which must have taken a lot of extra effort. In terms of the regular work, the ongoing work that happens every year, is there anything you want to tell us about that?
Just so working with the municipal historians, we have just introduced what we call a house tag, which is a card that we hope will stay in homes that will give something of the history of homes. Think something like a genealogy for houses. And what we're trying to do with this is to get people to do their own research. We're holding workshops. One has been held in Lansing with a lot of very excited people wanting to participate this. This is being done in conjunction with Historic Ithaca. And the house tag would stay in the house and give you some sense of what the history of the house is all about. The other reason to do it is not just for the information. It's to get people involved in looking at their own lives in time and documenting their own lives. So there are a couple of reasons why we're doing this.
Thank you.
Peter.
Carol, I have a question about the Civil War.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that during the Civil War, there were serious anti-draft riots in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any mention of that locally in Ithaca?
Oh, yes, there was mention. There were not draft riots here, but Tompkins County by 1863 was paying a relatively high bounty to get people to enlist. And if you look at the enlistment notices, it will give the names of the people who were willing to enlist for about $100 bounty plus another $50 plus aid for their families, which was a considerable amount of money. But then you will also see names that are not county names that say from out of the area. People were buying boys who would have enlisted in Pennsylvania. We were bringing them up here to enlist to increase the county numbers, which was to increase the numbers that the state had to provide. The state was given a quota by the federal government. We did not have
a mandate, right?
Oh yes. It's been going on for a long time. We didn't have riots here, but we did have a very strong peace Democrat or Copperhead presence in Ithaca. We had Copperhead conventions in Ithaca. And it's this difference of opinion that I think the Civil War Commission really wants to bring out, that we weren't all abolitionists, that we were not all on the moral side, that some of us had other interests at heart. And it's that conflict that we were really interested in.
Frank, who actually was in the Civil War, do you want to...
He looks like a Copperhead to me.
No, he's not from the right part of the county. he was a Republican.
Even then?
Yeah, even then.
Carol, I still have my original uniform, but it's a CSA uniform. If you'd like to have it. Typical of the county legislature, we discuss things in direct proportion to the amount of money that we have to allocate. Since this is a $7,000 budget, we will take 4 hours to discuss it. Mm-hmm. However, there's a scholarship effort going on for the nurses. Can you say something more about that? Because some of us are pretty interested in that.
Thank you so much.
that was not a setup.
Right? This was a thank you. one of the things that interested me having to do with the Civil War, has to do with our connection to the past. This is, and has been since 1826, what was called a very transient community. People were always coming and going. Very few people were born here. There's just a lot of mobility in this county. And so why should we, who are newcomers, relatively care about the past? And one of the things we wanted to do was to link the history of these four women who went to nurse during the war. One was from Dryden, one was from Enfield, one lived the rest of her life in Ithaca, and one was from the town of Ulysses. And the one from the town of Ulysses was the first woman in New York State to volunteer to become a nurse. So these are interesting women, and they have interesting patterns. And it's nice to learn about the past, but what we wanted to do was to link this effort to honor those women with the fact that we have in the county a fine nursing program. And by naming scholarships for these nurses and naming a professorship for one of them, what we'd like to do is to link the beginning of the nursing profession, which starts during the Civil War. We'd like to link the women's history to the present today. And today, as you know, the nursing program at TC3 has men as well as women, and we're hoping for some men getting these scholarships as well as women. When we did a presentation about this at the History Center, a whole batch of TC3 students came, and a couple of the men said, well, I'm going to go for one of those scholarships. So it's a nice way of linking the past and the present. And also, frankly, our need for good nursing. If we haven't needed good nurses yet, all of us are going to. And we are producing good nurses from that program, and 80% of the TC3 nurses stay around in the area. So it seems like a really good effort.
Have you met Sigrid Connor? Thanks, Carol.
Let us end with that. Carol, thank you for your work, your information, and certainly your passion.
Well, thank you for letting me come. I appreciate it.
Why don't you have them? Why aren't you passing them?
I think one thing about the scholarship is we're hoping that we have a lot of people give whatever they're comfortable to show that people in the county really are supporting this. We would love large donations, but we really need to have wide representation. So whatever you can give, I hope to have all of your names on the scholarship list, and I'll check. All right?
Thanks again. We have, let's do the health department, and then we'll do a break as listed on the sheet. Let me just say the line item budget is on page 95. The OTRs are 039 to 047 on 26-237.
Good evening, everyone. We'd like to thank Carol for the discussion on the nurses. It certainly was really great for us from the health department. Like many departments and organizations that you've already heard from over the last several weeks, this has been a particularly difficult budget year for the health department. Losses in state aid, reductions in revenue sources, including grants and fees, have had an impact on our budget and continue to impact us as we receive more information from Albany almost on a regular daily basis these days. The department has seen increases in the issuance of permits, enforcement actions, caseloads and early intervention are increasing above the state recommended acceptable range, communicable disease response and investigation continues to increase each year, as well as services in other areas of the department continue to increase or remain stable. The ability for us to respond to a pandemic, remember H1N1 last year, or other public health emergencies. You've heard us talk about foodborne illness, meningococcal outbreaks will be significantly diminished with further erosion in staffing and the potential closing of the certified home health agency. Emergency preparedness requirements such as conducting drills, writing and updating plans, maintaining 24/7, 365 days a year on call, all continue with reductions in funding coming from the state and the federal government. And we don't see those requirements going away, but continue to be a mandate for us. In addition, the department faces losses in state aid reimbursement if we don't show a maintenance of effort. We have a maintenance of effort requirement under our Article 6 standards, and that is all tied to our Municipal Public Health Services Plan that outlines the activities and the things that we will do as a county. It's important that you understand the impacts of these proposals as presented by our division managers as we present on behalf of clients who may not be able to come and advocate for themselves. Or as we identify issues that relate to public health and safety. The first priority in our OTR list is the certified home health agency. We're going to kind of walk through each of our OTRs in the priority order that's in the book so that you don't have to keep flipping back and forth. So our staff will switch periodically as the division managers speak on those OTRs.
My name is Sigrid Connors, and I'm Director of Patient Services at the Health Department. So I'm going to speak about the OTR, which in your book is number 39. And that is to preserve the continued operation of our certified home care program in 2011, pending the results of a comprehensive and unbiased study. This is a restoration of the county administrator's recommended cut. There is no doubt as to the need for home care. I don't think there's any question in here, and Carol certainly gave us a good segue that all of us will probably need it at one point or another. We serve people who are seriously ill, who no longer need the services of a hospital, but still need care. And our nurses, physical therapists, occupational speech therapists, and home health aides go into the home and provide that care. And so we're that link, we're that bridge. And I say the word certified. We are a certified agency, which means that we meet more stringent requirements in order to serve people in their home, and we are able to bill for Medicare and Medicaid services. These are the federal services, and that billing is important. I have some points I would like to make with you, and this program has, we have a short amount of time, but I'm going to try to get through these as quickly as I can. And also, I am aware that you have not had your break yet. So I want to point out that in 2009, home care had a 98% satisfaction rate. And from 2003 to 2009, the state gave our agency its highest ratings and highest quality ratings. And that recently, 9 out of 12 quality indicators were the same or better for our agency in comparison to other publicly run home care programs in upstate New York. So if you compare public home care agencies, we have fared very well. So what is the question now before us? And really that is, why should public health continue to provide home care? First of all, we serve everyone, people with insurance and people without insurance. That is our mission and that of the health department. And when other agencies were unable to care for their patients because of the need to reduce or stop services, we were there to meet that need. Third, and this is most critical point in why we need public health, is that we serve patients who have complex or high-level care needs who might exceed the resources of a not-for-profit agency. These patients require extensive, highly skilled care whose next step, if we were not here, would most likely be in a hospital or a nursing home at a higher cost. Reimbursements do not cover the cost of these services. And in a review of our current patient caseload, we have 74 patients on our caseload right now. 17 or 23% of our current caseload accounts for that type of patient. Would these patients still get served if another agency, not-for-profit, came? Yes, they would, but not by home care, because their reimbursement is just too little to cover the excess costs and needs. If we lose our home care program, we will lose our surge capacity. We have 11 registered nurses in our home care program, and these nurses will no longer be available to assist in an emergency event such as the H1N1 clinics that Brenda mentioned. Our depth of field to respond to critical events will be lost. The division RN pool that is in my programs will be reduced to 7.3 FTE, and that's in service to all of our other programs in maternal child, immunizations, lead, communicable disease, the flu, seasonal flu shots, and health promotion. Five, we will lose nurses with medical and surgical clinical expertise to operate a special needs medical shelter. And that is an expectation the state has of us and that of the community. If we do not have those nurses, we can't staff that type of shelter. These are very specialized medical, surgical skills. And so we will have to turn back to the community to say, how will this need be met? There are 15 positions in our home care program. And these, many of them, due to seniority, will bump or retreat in other titles in our health department, in those of Sylvia's program or Liz Cameron in our environmental health program. Nurses have specialized skills, and orientation takes a year or more to the very specialized documentation, clinical needs, and accounting requirements. The loss of these experienced nurses and disruption will cause a major disruption to the continuity of care in our operating functions. Services and billing will be delayed until the staff is oriented. There'll be quite a domino effect in the health department because of that. Seven, we will need to submit an RFP for another agency to serve our patients, and a transition of continuity of care must be assured for the state to approve that plan. Eight, we will need to apply to the state to operate a licensed home care agency. There will be a cost to obtain and maintain that license, such as annual cost reports and other state requirements. And we need that license in order to continue the other home care services we provide for the mothers, pregnant mothers in our moms program, and for the home visits we make in communicable disease to our TB patients. We need that license in order to go into the home. And because we would be a licensed agency, we will not be able to bill for Medicare and Medicaid services. So we will need to turn around and contract with another CHA in order to bill for those Medicaid, Medicare services. Lastly, the indirect costs, such as administration for the health department, will go up because the home care program absorbs a certain amount of these services. So there are many factors involved. There is no doubt to the fact that the home care program lost its state aid funding in this past year. There's a possibility that state aid may be reinstated, but not before you have your critical votes in November. If that state aid is reinstated, it still would not cover all of the expenses and the county taxpayer dollars because of the patients that I mentioned, the 17 patients or 23% of our caseload. And those patients alone that we looked at currently account for about $125,000 loss in our budget. So, again, these patients will be served, but not by us, probably not by a not-for-profit agency, and they will certainly not be provided in a home setting, which is where all of us would prefer to be.
So.
Yes, Tom.
This OTR, this particular issue is a big one and complicated. Would it be okay if, before you folks go on to the other OTRs, could we stay on the CHA issue and ask questions? Would that be okay, Jim?
Yeah, that would be fine. Nate, you had your hand up? Do you want to let her finish this portion?
No, I'm finished.
Oh, you're ready to go?
Okay. Thanks very much, Jim.
Let me ask one question. Do we have a copy of what you were reading?
I will send one out tomorrow.
Okay. Please put your hands up again. Martha, you were there. Then we'll go Nate, Will, Carol, Peter. Okay?
Okay. I'm sure a lot of the same questions are going to come up. I'll just pick one. You mentioned something about medical and special needs shelter. I'm not sure what you mean. In our emergency preparedness plans for Tompkins County, we have prepared a plan for meeting the needs of people who cannot be served in a regular American Red Cross shelter. They will not take people who have needs that exceed their staff. So we have a plan and agreement with Red Cross that if there were a need, we would be operating that special needs shelter. And we would be doing that drawing upon our experience and quality staff in our home care program. But we won't, if we don't have the CHA home care program, we won't have those nurses to back up. Well, we'll have other nurses, but we won't have as many. That's where you talked about your surge capacity. We will have less of a deep bench, you're saying.
But they will not have the type of medical and surgical clinical skills necessary that we would most likely see a need for in the shelter. They would have skills, and yes, they would have many skills to offer, but not the critical kind that might be needed.
Is there some kind of state definition of exactly what training is required to operate that shelter?
I don't believe that there is in any. I don't believe there is for training.
So this is our. This is our definition of what would be needed in the shelter.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Nate.
You mentioned that your program has 98% patient satisfaction. How are the surveys given? What's the scale for patient satisfaction? Because, you know, knowing a little bit about patient satisfaction, I mean, you can get a lot of people that give you a 4, but you get very few people that are willing to give you 5s for your, and 4 could still be satisfied. So I just want to know what your methodology is in determining that.
We have a survey that's a one-page survey that we've been sending out for probably over 10 years.
Okay.
We have an average of 500 patients that we serve a year.
Okay.
And I was just going to look to see.
And it's given to every patient?
Every patient, and those that remain on our caseload over a year, they get it every year. Mm-hmm. We had a 20% return on our patient satisfaction surveys.
Okay. And then in terms of what is the definition of satisfaction?
It addresses their care in terms of each of the services they received, whether it was nursing, therapy, home health aid service. It addressed were we timely? Did we treat them with respect? Did we answer their questions? That's the type of questions that we're asking.
And then is it based on a scale of any sort? Is
yes.
It 1 through 5?
Yes.
Do you have a breakdown?
I don't have that with me, but I could provide you a copy.
I would just like to know exactly how much, you know, because it's like I said, it's one thing to have good service, it's another to have excellent service, and that's the trend in healthcare, to mm-hmm. aim for excellent service, and so mm-hmm. that's what I want to, mm-hmm. I would love to know about.
I will add that we will be stopping that patient survey as of this month because the federal government is now set a standard survey questionnaire that every single certified home health agency will be using throughout the country, and we will be starting in October.
Okay.
So that's contracted to a separate vendor.
Gotcha. Okay.
I have Will, then Carol.
Thank you. So building on that question a little bit, I was checking our website, and we reference the study from 2002, but what I heard you say is that you actually have more recent numbers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So I think that's one question I think that's come up. Are we truly providing good to excellent care? And it sounds like mm-hmm. we are, but we need to, mm-hmm. to see that evidence. Second thing, in our budget we have allocated, or the proposed budget, tentative budget, we've allocated essentially half year's worth of support for the CHA plus some amount of money for a study to consider the alternatives. What would that study include? And I don't know if you want to take that or Joe or somebody. What will be looked at and examined in that study?
Well, we'll be looking at the services we provide. We'll be looking at the coding we use, the billing systems we use, the reimbursements from our contracts, the efficiency of our services. I really think it would be very comprehensive, so that's really just a tip of the iceberg of what we would really want to look at. And I need to mention about the quality issue that when you are serving more patients than usual with higher service needs and critical needs that don't do as well, your quality ratings will not always reflect the care that you give. So our quality ratings are skewed, which is why I mentioned other public health agencies, because we tend to serve more of those patients that would not be served by other agencies.
So, I understand. So we will take anybody, whereas others can essentially cherry pick the system.
As long as it's a safe care plan.
Yeah. And finally, if somebody cannot be served by us, if our service did not exist, you said that they might go to a more expensive alternative. Presumably a nursing home might be one of those. Who would end up paying in that case?
Most likely they would be cared for under Medicaid. Medicaid is the payer for the majority of patients. They may have Medicare or other private insurance, but that usually quickly is eroded. So Medicaid would fall back to our cost.
That would be
our cost. I know we don't pay 100% of the nursing home Medicaid costs, but I'm not familiar with the formulas.
Thank you.
I have Carol.
I want to explore also this notion of how well we're not, and what are the differences in our service, public service, of this nature versus private service. You mentioned a rating system and the ways in which we compare favorably to other public services of this type. Is there then a separate scale for private agencies, and do they tend to be higher ratings or lower ratings?
There's not a separate scale. They're all measured on the same indices. When we took a look at all of the agencies upstate, we looked at those that were public and did a comparison to them, and that's where I got the 9 out of the 12 quality indicators were the same or better, and that was from Home Care Compare.
Okay, and then can you say anything about where the public agencies compare to the private agencies on that same scale?
We don't fare as well.
Okay, and so can you talk a little bit to us about how, what are the things that we do better versus the things that, what are the cases in which I as a consumer might want to go to a private agency versus this? And then is it all an all or nothing proposition? Are there ways in which we could serve certain parts of the population better?
I really can't say that.
So as well.
That we're better than another agency. I mean, that's really not my position to say that. We can speak well to what we do. We provide a quality service, and we can provide more detail on that. There's a new questionnaire that was put in place by the federal government, assessment data that's called OASIS-C, and we are just beginning to get the data back on that. And they're showing very favorable results for us. And I can send that information out to everyone as well.
Do we have any information yet on people who are turned away by private agencies and then come to us? What percentage of the people that come to our service
have been turned away elsewhere?
I don't have a
percentage, and I'm not able to give a percentage because we don't know. We receive referrals, but we don't know about all of the referrals that are out there. We never know how many referrals we might have had because they come from all of the area hospitals, Syracuse, Rochester, Buffalo, Elmira, and Pennsylvania. We can't know some of those details.
I have Peter and then Frank and then Pat.
Jim, I don't have a question, but there's something I want to say. Is that okay at this meeting?
Yeah.
Huh? Yes or no?
Yes, please do.
Okay. I feel a sense of frustration here. This is one of the big issues that we're facing, I understand. And I've received a lot of mail from people, and it all asked me to make a decision in one particular way. And I've never heard an argument for not making that decision. And I don't understand how I'm going to be able to make a decision, a sensible decision, without hearing that. And I don't know when that's going to happen. I'm sorry not to understand the process better, but that's just the way I'm feeling as I listen here at around the table. So can you help me, Jim?
May I help you? Well, the only thing I think that I can say, and maybe the county administrator wants to get in on this at some point, part of the budget is that the CHOP program is put together, moving forward for 6 months during the time when we would do an evaluation of the program. I think what you would do today after hearing the people is try to ask the questions you can, but I've heard two answers already. Carol asked a question about a comparison, and they rightfully answered, look, we know what we do. We don't know what these other people do. So until we get some information from our own survey, I don't think that they rightfully can answer any of those kind of questions.
Okay, well, my question is that everybody says that it's much better if we do it in-house, if we just continue it. So why are we doing a survey? Why don't we just continue going ahead with what we have? What's the matter?
Because we have a $400,000 cost, and the county administrator recommended a cut in that program, and there has to be a reason to do that. And what we're looking for is to evaluate the program as best we can over the next 6 months. And Joe?
And I think that really does convey my recommendation to the legislature here. This is a program that a year ago cost about $270,000 local dollars. That local subsidy increased to $400,000 for 2011 because of the pullback of state aid, so it's gotten significantly more expensive over the past year or so. As I've said a few times now, I'm recommending a two-step process here. The first step is to take a careful clinical look at whether we can reduce the local cost of providing this service as a government-run operation. And that's what Sigrid and Brenda have talked about in terms of basically bringing in a consultant to look at that question. Can we get this close to break even? And there is an OTR of $25,000 in here to pay for it. At some point soon, I'm going to recommend that we accelerate that, and we don't wait until 2010 to do that. We do that in 2011. We do that in 2010. We get that started right away, because I don't think anybody would object to the idea of trying to reduce the out-of-pocket costs of this service. So that's step one. Can we get it close to break even? If we can't, I've suggested that there are viable alternatives to a county-run operation. Right now, in New York State, there are 57 upstate counties. 42 of them do have county-run CHAs, and many of those counties have not only a county-run CHA, but like us, they also have a not-for-profit, call it private, home health agency as well in that same county. 42 were in that situation, which means that 15 didn't have a county-run CHOG. So services were being provided to the community of need without a county-operated CHOG in those 15 communities. Now, with the changing economics of these home health agencies over the past few years, over the past 2 years, 10 counties have chosen to divest themselves of their CHOG, to basically get out of the business. Six of those have already happened. Four are in progress right now. And, Peter, when that happens, the county's involvement in terms of monetary involvement ends. So it's not as if we are contracting with an agency to provide a service and we have an out-of-pocket to support that. The county at that point is out of the business, and that work is taken over by a non-governmental operation that has to basically perform it at break even. And again, throughout New York State, there are scores of not-for-profit providers that do that, including in some counties, that is the only vehicle to provide service at all, home health care. So I came from a county that got out of the business. And I do know that people who need service in that other county, Onondaga County and the 15 others who are out of it, receive service. So, again, in terms of my recommendation, that's the basis of it. But in the recommendation, woven into it carefully, is care and deliberative steps forward, beginning with a study of whether or not we can do it in-house at a lower cost. If we decide that we can't, and we decide at that point to proceed on an equally careful, maybe more so, study to make sure that the people that we care about, the clients, will be served with quality, even if the county gets out of the business. The last thing I'd like to say is basically the structure of the recommendations. The budget supports a half year at status quo. It takes money out for the second half of the year. But if you take a look at some of the sections of the budget message, you'll see in there that we've also created a safety net for ourselves. So in the contingency fund, there is one-time money of $196,000 to carry this for the second half of the year if we find that we need that additional time to do this right. So there's a target of 196 to support it for a half year. There's a one-time of another 196 in contingency just in case we need that extra time.
Okay, now I have a question. And my question is, are you arguing that we should not do what the county administrator is recommending?
Yes.
Is that correct?
We're asking you to preserve and maintain a public operating home care agency.
So you're suggesting we not even study that option?
No, we are absolutely in agreement with the study, and we are expediting that study because that's coming forth to the health committee in the next couple of weeks. So we're going forth now instead of waiting until 2011 because we really need that study to be started.
Okay, that helped a little bit.
I have Frank, Pat,
thank
Ryan,
you.
Nate, Martha.
Thanks, Jim. I'm glad that the jury sort of is still out on because the study that's being spoken about is an absolute necessity. It'll help even the department identify some of the items that we're now doing that may be able to be done better. I mean, I don't think there's any reason why we can't do that. The question that I have centers around the type of patient that we see in the CHOG. This is like a five-part question, Sigrid. If I'm not mistaken, even a private agency still has the right to refuse to take any particular patient if they deem for whatever reason there's no coverage, they're incorrigible, or whatever it happens to be. Well, is that true?
Not quite, no, because the regulations require that agencies accept all patients on many factors. But if the needs exceed their resources,
then they can refuse.
Then they can refuse. And we have had to do that from a few times because we lost a physical therapist in our budget, in our program, and we did not have enough physical therapy on staff to accept every referral we received last year. So that's a case where if you don't have the staff, you can't do the service.
Well, ironically, a discussion of this service took place at the Lansing, at Myers Park, at the Veterans Watch Fire, because several of the individuals that are Vietnam veterans and Korean veterans fall into the category where they can't afford services and the Archives taking care of them. One of the individuals is a tough nut, I'll tell you that. And the concern that some of us have is that a private agency, and by the way, they develop a rapport with whomever the nurse is or whoever is going in to take care of them. The concern that some of the folks had out there was they may not get the same level of service that our agency is that our in-house agency is giving them, and that's a major concern for them. But at any rate, we're not really making a decision to do away with this at this point. Certainly not tonight, because we're waiting for that study to be done. But as Brenda, maybe you can help me with this part. Even if we decide, if we were to decide to do away with the our license, it isn't an automatic, we can do it by the middle of next year or even perhaps by the end of next year. Isn't there a time period by which the DOH has to weigh in and something like 18 months before you can do away with the license? So we may have to carry the license and the responsibility all through 2011?
The requirements will be, I think Sigrid outlined them, is that we would, the purchasing or the transitioning company would have to file a certificate of need process with the state health department. Certificate of needs take a fairly long time for the state health department to process. We all know we just went through that process for 55 Brown Road, a little bit on a different side because we were talking about facility versus actual services, but state health department does not move those along very rapidly. The estimate that I have gotten from our accountant is that it could take a 12 to 18 month period in which to process and actually complete a transition and implementation plan. Whether that can be expedited or not will be something that needs to be researched throughout the process.
County Administrator.
I think in many cases when there has been this kind of a transition, Once the county, through an RFP process, decides what vendor will get the business, there's very quickly a contract between the county and that vendor to transfer services at that time to that vendor to make sure that there is a continuity of care, the clients continue to be assured that there'll be coverage. So that can occur even before the certificate of need happens. And I think as you're reading about things that are happening right now in other counties, that's generally the model that they are following. So once they get done with the RFP process and they select their vendor, they contract with that vendor to provide the service at that time.
Well, Jim, I want to stay on that for just a second. Joey, if I heard you right, there's perhaps 15 counties that are doing this privately now?
Well, there were. 2 years ago, there were, and now there are 10 more, or will, over the next little while, be another 10. So there'll be up to 25 counties who are out of the business.
Is it possible, I mean, if it's public information or perhaps we can get some reading on level of service and I want to go back to Carol's question. Is there some way to get some reading, yeah, maybe from the DOH, on how, which of those entities are providing excellent service or whatever it is?
Yes, yeah. The State Health Department has a rating system. There's a federal Medicare rating system, so we can get that information, yes. If I could just wedge one other thing into this. Through the RFP process, again, concerns about the complete coverage provided to people can also be addressed through an RFP. So if there are concerns that there are individuals who currently receive care by the county and who might not by a vendor, the RFP can be structured to make sure that the vendor knows that that is a requirement of them in this transition. I know when Onondaga County did it, that was hardwired into the RFP, that they would pick up the same kinds of clients that the county historically had taken.
Okay, just and one last one, Jim. Sigrid mentioned the 15 nurses that are currently in the program.
11. It's 11. 15 staff physicians and 11 nurses.
The most recent instance that any one of us around this dais can remember is the H1N1 escapade of when we needed a lot of help in a short period of time. There have been other instances that go back over a number of years where our staff has provided help in other venues, and we were able to dispatch our professional staff to help out. So it isn't just – that's just an example of the backup that we have. And please, if there's an opportunity, maybe it might not be a bad idea. Is it possible – to get, maybe not tonight, but to provide us with some other examples where our staff has been called upon to go into the community to help out. I mean, some of us remember 20 years ago when AIDS was not spoken of in as well, you know, in open discussion as much as it is today. And there have been instances where we've had to provide help for HIV and what have you. So I'd certainly think it'd be helpful to the 15 of us if we could have some other examples of that, because cutting 11 people loose doesn't sit well with me.
Pat.
Jim, I had several questions, and several of them have been addressed, but I would like to, if I may, speak to some of the questions that people have asked, starting with Nathan, that I think go to qualitative as opposed to quantitative kind of ways of measuring. And I'm the county's representative to the Office for the Aging Advisory Board. And as Frank mentioned, he had a conversation with a group of people where this came up. Well, this topic came up at our last meeting of the advisory board. And there were a number of people on the advisory board who have experienced receiving services from the county and from private providers here in Tompkins County. And to a person, they were very, very concerned to think that we may lose the county service because the county service is so far superior to that of the private providers. And they gave example after example of the ways in which that was true. And as I said, it tends to be qualitative, anecdotal, as opposed to quantitative information. But I can tell you that that's what was said to us. I have personally experienced receiving services for both of these agencies following surgery when I needed to have people come into the house for both physical therapy and for nursing services after my surgeries. And I can tell you that another way in which there's a real qualitative difference in the service is that the private service, which was the one that I had first, was very insensitive to the cultural differences which exist in my home because of the fact that I'm a lesbian. And there were some very insensitive things said to me and said during the course of the conversation by the nurse that appeared there from the private nursing service. So the next time I had to have someone, I called the county health services. And the county health people sent a male nurse, actually, who would never blink an eye, was totally accepting, was perfectly at ease being in my home, and responded perfectly appropriately to the situation as he found it. And to me, that was a critical difference. So I just feel like I want that information out there.
Brian.
A lot of them have been asked and answered. Just a couple of quick ones. Essentially, are we talking about the difference between you folks and a private company, RNs versus home health aid?
No.
So they are certified nurses as well?
An alternate, there are two certified agencies. There are two certified agencies in Tompkins County, and that's dictated by the State Health Department. If we are no longer in service at the Health Department, then, as Joe mentioned, an RFP would be put out and another agency would be bidding for it. The existing CHI in Tompkins County cannot bid for this service because they already provide the service. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be a single entity CHI in this community.
Okay.
We would each serve, each would have to serve the same type of services.
Okay. I'm just talking about the qualifications of the individuals within both entities.
They would have to meet the same state standards.
Okay. They're nurses, just like you folks.
Because, nurses and therapists.
Because there are agencies that are home health aides that virtually have no qualifications.
Right, and those are licensed agencies.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
And there are many of them.
Okay. Just as a matter of how things are run, do some of these agencies, for example, hire nurses that have either left your employment or they've retired from the county, or do you folks utilize retired persons that have retired from the county yet they still work part-time?
I can't speak to the other agencies, but we have several nurses that have retired from our own services,
mm-hmm.
who do part-time per diem work for our nurses.
Okay. And specifically in this program?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Because we have a 24/7 requirement to be servicing Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays,
mm-hmm.
our full-time staff get need some assistance to help cover those hours and days.
Yep. Good. And I'm glad that that's happening because of the obvious benefits, not only financially for us, in terms of fringes that are no longer needing to be paid, but these people are they're trained by us, they're experienced in the county, and it's good that we're utilizing them. And that should probably be part of the evaluation process, showing that we actually do utilize these people. I'm assuming that's got to be at a significant savings.
Well, we hire as many as we possibly can. There are no benefits to the per diem positions,
mm-hmm.
So it we try to get as many. We have three currently on staff.
Okay. I actually have some other questions, and I don't normally do this. A lot of these other people do, but I don't. I ask a question or two, maybe. But I think they would probably be better off during our own deliberations, so I'm gonna hold those. Thank you.
I have Nathan.
So who's your primary payer? I have a few questions.
Medicare,
right. Now, so you guys work, you get paid through a prospective payment system?
Yes,
then through that.
Under Medicare.
So in Medicare, the prospective payment system gives additional payment for outliers in that
mm-hmm.
system.
Mm-hmm.
Have you, I mean, I understand that probably with the study it will happen, but in the past, you know, however many years we've been in operation, so how many times have we actually brought in outside consulting groups to assess whether or not we're getting as much as we can through an outlier payment or through this prospective payment system? Have we ever done that?
Our accountant has addressed some of those questions with us.
Yeah.
But I have to say, as much as we would like to bring in outside vendors to help us with that, we have had to cut that out of our budget.
Right.
We've had to cut training and or specialized services like that.
Right.
But we do maximize the coding to get the billing that we need to do. Can we probably do a little bit more? Yes. But the problem is that even with that, the coding and meeting those requirements, the reimbursement isn't enough.
Right.
And Medicare's assumption is that you're serving people on both sides of the curve.
Right.
so that you're serving people that have less costs. And that helps to cover the cost for those that cost more. But as public health agency, as I said, 23% of our current caseload has very high needs.
Right.
So we're not able to balance that out.
Can we make, I mean, for this study, because, I mean, I would love for it to stay in the county. I just want us to make sure that we do everything that we can to increase our payments so that we can make it break even. I think that, you know, at least from my what limited experience I have in healthcare so far, I mean, I work at a place where we have a team of people that works with nothing but nurses to make sure that they're coding things accurately so that we can receive the most payment, the most accurate payment possible, right? And that has yielded millions in difference, you know. And so I really, for this study, I mean, it's quality, of course. And also, I mean, looking at this payment structure, I think has to absolutely be key. And I think it would be if we didn't include this in the study, there wouldn't be a point to the study, frankly. It wouldn't be enough.
It's definitely,
I think we all agree,
part of it. Yes, yes.
Thank you, Nate. Martha?
Thank you. And listen, I want to thank the people behind me because I know this is, we're way past the schedule, but this is really important. And this is the time when we can understand what's involved here. So I have a couple of questions. You said that there are two certified agencies in the county. So, and then the existing CHOC can't, but then you really confused me. So are you saying we have a CHOC license and there's another agency that also has the same license?
Yes, their agency has one of the two and we have the other one.
So that means some people who are needing this care right now go to a private nonprofit agency that does the same thing and has the same regulations and standards to meet?
That's correct. It's a not-for-profit agency.
Okay, so this is, and I would make the distinction between proprietary and nonprofit. So I hope, I mean, if that's just a bias, that, you know, when we go on the RFP, nonprofit makes a difference, I think. So there's already a nonprofit providing the same exact services parallel to ours.
Yes.
So this would mean that our license would be, say, if we had an RFP, other agencies would apply. So the one that's already doing it can't bid for that. So that, in other words, we are required to maintain two licenses so people have a choice.
The state requires two certified agencies.
Okay. So that choice will be remained. So there's a choice now, and there will continue
right,
to be a
choice. There will continue to be a choice.
And the nonprofit CHOs, they have to meet all the same standards, regulations, people on service, training.
Correct.
For the.
Yeah.
When you said the license allows us as the provider to deny coverage if a patient's needs exceed our resources, and you mentioned the case where we didn't have enough physical therapists. What is there anything that would keep us from, having our staff and then turning down people? We would never do this. Then turning down people by saying, well, we don't have enough staff to serve those people. How is there some policy, some regulation that says that somebody can't deliberately keep trimming their services, maintain their license, but trimming back their resources so that they have the ability to turn away people who seem too difficult?
That's a state oversight issue. It's not something that we as another agency are able to know the details about that. Again, we don't know how many total referrals are coming in to Tompkins County to both CHOs. We have received numbers, so we know how many visits and patients the other agency has served, and we serve about 40% more than the other agency, 40% more volume.
So you don't know if that's because some people have been turned away by the first one.
We don't know.
Okay. All right. And finally, just one more question. You mentioned near the beginning that we've fared well comparing to other public agencies on 9 out of 12 ratings. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
But we then you, in response to a question, you said we don't fare as well as the private agencies? We don't compare as well to private agencies because of the type of caseload that we have. Well, can you compare? From what you said, it sounded like the private CHA in our county should have substantially the same caseload as we do in terms of kind of case, no? So how would you know why we don't compare as well?
Because we can take a look at what our caseload is. We can look at how ill that our patients are in comparison to the state. If we separate public-run home care agencies and look at them as one entity and compare them to private entities, the private entities have been doing better. That's not always been the case, but those numbers do fluctuate. And as I mentioned, there are some new data that's coming in that looks very favorable. And I think that I think when I get a chance to share that, you'll see that information. You know, the issue here is not whether we provide a better quality service than a newer agency that might come in. That's not really our argument, because all of us need to give quality care, all of us. The issue is the service to the patients that might not be served by the not-for-profit agencies. That's the issue. The other agency in Tompkins County has had a new director in the last year or so, and they're doing much better. But if you looked at our numbers in comparison to them, they had a much smaller caseload. And because they were not able to take high-tech cases, intravenous cases, high-tech wound care, we had a greater percentage of those patients. Our quality numbers are affected by the type of patients we serve versus what they served.
Okay. Then I'm going to ask that whatever this consultant study includes, somehow there has to be an apples-to-apples comparison of a private nonprofit entities with similar caseloads. And do you know what I'm saying? I mean, unless the thesis here is that the public agencies simply take people that the private agencies don't, even with the same state regulations. I need to know that that's true. So far, I don't know that that's true. Thank you very much.
I have Carol, Will, Frank, Peter.
Hey. I put my hand up.
You have? I didn't see it, Julie. I'm sorry. All of you, I've heard some wonderful statements, and all due respect to all of you, I've heard wonderful statements that would be appropriate for voting time and not question time. So please keep that in mind. Yeah. Carol.
Thank you, Sigrid, for bearing with us. If we weren't grappling with this decision, we wouldn't be asking you so many questions. So please don't take it personally.
No, it's fine. You're doing your job.
I'm trying to understand more about this, the license, and how that would work and a contract. So if there's a contract, are we then still paying the agency, or are they paying us for the contract? Do we make money on this license, or does it still cost us something? And that may be for Joe.
I think Joe can answer that better, because he's done more research on that.
In terms of the divestiture, getting out of the business, the county would actually, or could actually, sell its certificate, and there's a value that a vendor would be willing to pay for it. I don't think we ought to even consider that as a factor. I mean, it's a one-time event, but there would be a value that a vendor would pay for the right to have the certificate to operate the CHA. Once that happens, once we divest, that's it. So the $400,000 that we currently put into the CHA would go to zero. We wouldn't be in that business anymore. Now, if your question was during that interim period, so we've done an RFP, we selected a vendor, if we decide to go that way, selected a vendor, and while waiting for the certificate of need, we get into a contractual relationship with the vendor to provide the service until they get the CON. then my presumption has been we will be at a break even at that point. They will operate under their normal rules. They become a contract vendor to us, but their reimbursement streams and all that are as they would be if they ran the CHA themselves. So at that point, our net cost would fall to zero.
Okay, but then the contract would still come through us, or we would be out of
during that interim period. During the interim period, we'd have to contract with them. That would come from us to the vendor. But once that certificate of need is granted to the vendor, that then takes us out of the business completely, and we don't have a contract. We're not in that line of work anymore.
If I can clarify quickly, we used to run a county hospital. We don't run the hospital anymore. It's a private nonprofit. Many counties still run nursing homes themselves, still run hospitals themselves. This is a similar structure. Am I right?
That's okay. Absolutely right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Can I ask then, so when we decided to get out of the business of running a hospital, did we put it into our budget before we did the studies to determine which one would be best?
Frank was here.
Was anybody alive when we did that? It was the best move Tompkins County ever made. Go ahead.
We had, it used to be called Tompkins, it was Tompkins Community Hospital in those days, and it actually was on Valentine's Place.
Many miserable days there.
But we had issued bonds for the new hospital and eventually for the doctor's facility up there, and that's why we were entitled to keep a seat on the board of directors for, it wasn't Cuba Medical Center, it was still Tompkins Community Hospital. Until the bonds were paid, it was part of our budget because we had to account for the bonding, and there was income coming from the to the county on the bonds. But once those bonds were paid, it was not part of our budget responsibility anymore.
Okay, so just a follow-up to that. So is there anything preventing us, if we don't put this into the budget this year, you know, if we do something with the ARBOR target requests so that we maintain the program for this year, is there anything preventing us then from, is this a now or never decision, or can we do the studies, find out the results of them sometime in 2011, and look at it again for 2012?
Sure.
Will.
Thank you, Jim. Question for Joe. If somebody's willing to pay us money for this, it's got to presumably have some value. Are the economics different for a nonprofit than they are for us? Do they have obligations or a different payment system or something that makes it a better deal for them than it is for us that you're aware of?
I think the reimbursement rates, I think, are the same for them and the county. I'd have to look to Sigrid.
They might have a different negotiated contract rate than we do.
And that's something that we want to look at, too,
as part of our
internal review. We want to look to see if our rates are as high as they can be. Their cost structure is probably different than ours. I mean, we talk about our fringe rates a lot. My sense is their fringe costs are lower than ours. Their overhead costs may be lower than ours as well. I think you'll find a pattern in New York State of several CHAs and several counties being operated by the same parent firm, so they can spread their overhead costs across a number of counties as opposed to just one. So I think on the expense side, that's where the major differences would lie. I'm just not familiar enough with Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates to know if they have a different rate structure than we do.
Thank you.
Frank, question, please.
Question, just clarification. Back in the days when it was a community hospital, Louis Pasteur and Albert Schweitzer are people I served with on that board.
So Madame Curie.
Now the question, and Madame Curie, thank you. I'd forgotten about her. Sigrid, just clarification. If, going back to something you said about if a private pay or a private agency, whether it's not-for-profit or proprietary, steps in and examines a patient's circumstances before they accept that patient, they can reject taking that patient on if the cost of care exceeds that organization's ability to pay for that care or whatever. Did I understand that right?
Technically, no. But there are ways to look at that in different angles that allow some agencies to not accept patients.
Okay.
There are ways around it. But technically, we are not allowed to deny anyone based on ability to pay or revenue source that we would get.
Now the county CHA, the one we currently have, because our ability to look at the resources is basically our tax rate, our tax base, and also if there ever is a reinstatement of the state's reimbursement, we don't enjoy, if you want to call it that, that same option. We take patients regardless of their ability to pay, right?
That's true, and that really is why we had state aid, because the state recognized that public CHAs did service to a population that might not have been served.
And I think that goes back to something Martha was asking, that we don't have the same option, if you will. We will take a patient regardless of their ability to pay or whatever it happens to be, or the ability to be reimbursed for their pay. I mean, that's where that $400,000 cost may come in, because we have to pay regardless.
Joe?
I think Sigrid and I are saying the same thing. I think there is an obligation on the part of any certified home health agencies to take patients regardless of means. I think that's the way the law reads. And the risk of a vendor, private, not profit, or government, in breaking that rule is they risk their certificate. So the state could come in and take action against that CHA, not-for-profit or government-run, if they deny care to an individual based on means. I think that's, at least when I look at the rules and the law, that's what I see, and it seems pretty clear.
But what I heard Sigrid say was that if that same agency looks at the level of care that the individual needs, and to provide that level of care, not necessarily the resources of the individual, but the resources of the agency, may be not adequate to cover the cost of that care, then the agency has the option of turning down that patient. We don't have that same option. We take the patient regardless, because we're either covering it through our county cost or hopefully someday the state's reimbursement. Do I have that right? Yeah.
But Sigrid said we did turn down somebody because we didn't have a physical therapist.
Well, that's because we didn't have a therapist that could provide the service.
That's the same thing
That's the question you're asking. Mm-hmm.
That's the same thing that the private agency could do. We've done it, too.
Mm-hmm. Peter.
I'm starting to think we're doing the study now around the table, but I don't really think that the people around the table are the right people. Great as my respect is for the intelligence and perceptiveness of my colleagues, I don't think we're the right people to do the study. I personally do not have a preference as to whether we have a private supplier or a not-for-profit supplier or a public supplier. To me, the question is what we have an obligation to the people in Tompkins County who get this need, who have this need, and what is the most efficient way for us to supply that service, and I don't know the answer to that question. It seems pretty simple-minded, but frankly, I see that there are two issues. There are two things that we could do. One thing we could do is to do this study and find out what is the best thing to do and structure it in such a way that all of the questions that have been expressed and the concerns that have been expressed around the table are met by the study, or to prejudge it and say, well, we know what the answer is. The right answer is for us to continue to provide this. And so let's not bother to do the study. I just don't think in this difficult time when we feel that it may be necessary for us to contract the services that we do, that it's right not to follow the course that says let's look into it and make a decision after we get the results.
Gee, thanks for your help. How many people want to prejudge and how many people want to do the study? We have Dooley next. Go ahead.
The CHA comes under the Division for Community Health Care, is that right?
Yes.
I looked at that section in our big budget book and found it extremely difficult to read because of all the county administrators' changes in it. And I realized that some of the lines which have some changes represent positions which will continue to be filled by a smaller number of nurses or whatever. And when you were giving your initial presentation, you said something about you would lose your surge capacity in emergencies, but it also sounded as though there were other interlocking pieces in this division that didn't all become clear to me when you were talking. And I look forward to having a written version of what you said, but if you could include more information on those interlocking pieces, I would find that useful. When I was looking at this detailed budget, I was surprised to see a line called rent, and I was wondering what you rent.
The health department pays the county maintenance in lieu of rent on our facility at 55 Brown Road. A portion of that is applicable to the CHA and then thus gets assigned to that, much like CSCN has a piece of the maintenance of the lower end administration and so on for the entire department.
Well, I knew you'd be the right one to answer me about the finances. I was surprised to see it in many places, and now I understand that. And Joe, I have a question for you based on what you've been saying recently about your understanding of savings when another county has immediately contracted with a vendor that they've selected. Because I assumed that every patient would have to have a patient care plan, and I assumed that a vendor that gets chosen who has not yet been certified or licensed to operate in our county could not accept those patients. So I was wondering, maybe I'm wrong, but I was wondering what happens to patients currently served by our CHA if we get out of the business.
In the interim, are you talking about the interim or a permanent basis?
Well, not after the vendor has finally received the license, right. But in that period of time when you said we're suddenly out.
Those clients, and again, I want to make sure I'm understanding. So if we've made a decision that we're going to get out, and the CON has not yet been received by the vendor, is that the period we're talking about?
I think
so. Okay. Those clients would still be our clients. The way we choose to serve those clients would be via a contract with the vendor as opposed to our own staff doing that work.
But how could the vendor serve them if the vendor wasn't licensed to work in our county? I'm just confused. Tell me.
The vendor is a licensed vendor. I mean, frankly, Dooley, you're getting into an area where I can't give you all those answers. I don't know how that would work, but I do know that that's the model that's been followed in most of the counties where they've made this transition from a government-run operation to a not-for-profit.
Well, it was when you shared with me briefly the wording in the health law that applies. That's what raised the question for me.
Yeah, I would have to get the detailed answer on that.
Any other questions?
It's a different one.
It's about the health department?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
First, I want to acknowledge that you're all working with a vacuum and sort of a permanent directorship, and I appreciate that. And Brenda, you've really stepped in terms of sort of the budget issues here, and I thank you. So maybe I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, and I hope it's not too uncomfortable. If this... So your request, Joe has funded half a year of the CHA, or half of the deficit.
your request is to for it to be funded for the full year with target money, not the second half with one-time money. So you have other OTRs, which I know it's late, but I assume we're going to go into. The other OTRs that are funded are roughly the amount of money here that the second half of the CHA year would be. So I guess I'd have to ask you if you could have one or the other, if you could have the target funding for the CHA or all these other positions, would the CHA still be your top priority?
The managers and I have met on that very discussion item last week. And what we have come up with right now is that you cannot really rate an entire program against individual positions. It was very hard for us to rank those in that sense. And we are able to rate our priorities within our individual positions. Sigrid and I are the ones that did put the study process forward when we realized that Joe was really looking at the CHA for savings. We strongly feel that we need to do that process no matter what the decision of the legislature is. If you were to say, let's continue this funding and we'll put target money towards it, we strongly believe that we still need to do that. It makes good business sense, and it's an appropriate process in which to follow. It is difficult for us to rank our positions against our CHA. The positions all are very important. It is something that I have stressed to the Board of Health and to the management staff, that we cannot lose sight of the items that we put forward. So I can't give you an answer which I would rate higher, because we can't rate an entire program. I did advise management staff, and again today when we had a working meeting of the Board of Health, that this is the last year in which we really can nickel and dime and put positions forward on a piecemeal basis throughout the department. That next year, I expect we will have similar kinds of budget discussions and similar kinds of things that will have to go forward, and that we will have to look at programs that we no longer can continue to piecemeal to make a 6.9% reduction or whatever it is for 2012. That if we are going to render a service, we need to render it well. And if we cannot render it, then we need to put that on the table.
With regret, I think that's where we are right now. And I would quote your former commissioner, I think it was Alice, who often said, we can't keep doing everything with little cuts. You have to tell us what to stop doing. So as much as this could be an unpleasant choice, it could be better than the alternatives. And frankly, the idea that there is at least the option that another entity will pick up the choice puts it at a higher level over some of these other programs where nobody else is going to pick it up. Thank you very much.
Let me just finish up by saying to both of you that, one, we appreciate your time here and the length of time you spent here. I would love for you to give us a copy of your presentation and a survey, the patient survey that Nathan was referring to that you used for your CHA, and the interlocking pieces that Dooley Kiefer spoke of, and anything else that anyone has. Thank you very much. We have DSS. Do you want to take 5 minutes, or do you want to carry on? What? Oh. Sorry. I don't know. What do y'all want to do? You want to take a 5-minute break? Okay, we'll do that.